the rent is too damn high? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, we'll tell you why a new report says affordable housing is out of reach for millions of Americans. Are you one of them? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a look at the state's new hemp revolution, plus a preview of the Apex Theater's production of Chicago on a local stage this weekend. All of that ahead. But first this hour, a new report says affordable housing is out of reach for millions of Americans. The National Low-Income Housing Coalition says it's actually impossible for anyone in America who earns minimum wage, that's $7.25 an hour, to afford a basic apartment. Here in Jacksonville, there's been a push to build more affordable housing, but is it enough to meet the huge demand out there? Shannon Nasworth is president and CEO of Ability Housing, and she joins us now with more about this new out-of-reach report. Shannon, good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Do you think the rent is just too damn high? Tell us about your issues finding affordable housing in Northeast Florida. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open, too. Shannon, this report is just out. What does it show?
Well, unfortunately, it shows the problem is continuing to get worse. Rents are going up and wages are not. Luckily, in Florida, we do adjust our minimum wage when, each year. So it's gone up a little bit, but housing prices have gone up more. And so everybody is having a hard time finding an affordable place to live.
Okay. This report says to afford a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in America, you need to make a minimum of $22.96 an hour. That's a salary that's out of reach for millions of Americans. The report says people shouldn't spend more than 30% of their income on housing, but that's impossible for too many people, correct?
Absolutely. 30% is the ideal. And I think most households realize that's just not an option for most people. A lot of us are just striving to stay at below 40% of our income. We have far too many households that are literally paying more than half of their income for their housing, which means they're not spending money on good food, health care, all the other things that matter in raising a family.
And does this include both people who rent and people who are paying a monthly mortgage payment?
The report itself focuses on rental households. That's what the Low Income Housing Coalition report is about. But it's also true for home buyers. I think we all know that, especially for first-time home buyers, entry-level homes just don't exist out there. It's very hard for people trying to enter the homeownership market to get into houses.
And if you're just joining us as we talk about the new out-of-reach affordable housing report, we want to know, is rent a struggle for you? Are you having trouble saving up enough money to buy a home? Give us a call at 549-2937. Okay, this out-of-reach report shows that this is a problem in all 50 states and in every county in America. So I want to know, what's the picture like here in Florida for affordable housing? I am looking at these numbers and they don't look very good.
It doesn't look very good and is continuing to get worse. The state is growing, which is a wonderful thing. Our economy is booming, which is a wonderful thing. Unemployment is low, also a very good thing. Unfortunately, those jobs are not jobs that we can afford housing. Florida is a very low-wage industries with tourism and agriculture being two main employers, and they're just inherently are low-paying jobs. But also the average office workers and laborers on construction sites, the people who are building the housing can't afford the housing. I think that's the core issue. If you're building the housing, you should be able to afford to live there.
Now, this report has been coming out every year for 30 years.
Yes.
Beginning in the Reagan years, there was a shift in the way we handled low-income housing in America. What was that shift? What was the change?
Sure. Actually, this is a problem that is new. In the 70s, we actually had more affordable housing than we had need. I heard that at one time, and I had my staff do the research, and there is a HUD report showing in the 1970s, we had more affordable housing than there was need. In the 80s, we made the decision to stop investing in housing for extremely low-income households, but there was a recognition that there was sort of the middle-wage workers were having trouble affording housing, so we started creating housing for people earning about 60% of the area median income, which is needed. I'm not saying there isn't need in that bandwidth, but unfortunately, by making that shift and population grows, housing stock, doesn't increase, and we have this dire need now for housing for millions of Americans.
Now, recently in Jacksonville, there's been a push to create more affordable housing. Tell me about that.
Yes, and it is a good thing. We're trying collectively as a community to create more affordable housing. I think people have seen the properties in downtown that Vescore has built. We're building a new property on the west side. But we just need more. There's not enough resources. The state legislature keeps sweeping our affordable housing trust funds, which are desperately needed to layer with other sources so that we can create more housing. And it's just not happening.
Tell me more about that. The Affordable Housing Trust Fund for Florida. That is supposed to be money set aside for this need. But you're saying it doesn't always go to that need?
No, unfortunately it doesn't. It was created, about 30 years ago or so. I'm not exactly sure when. But basically, a very small percentage of dock stamps go into a trust fund that is supposed to be dedicated to affordable housing. And starting 10 more years ago, they started using it for other purposes. This past session, we thought there was a good chance we would get a good portion of it, if not all of it, dedicated to affordable housing. But unfortunately, a lot of it got redirected.
And that's rental assistance. Someone who's low income getting a little help to make their monthly rent? Is that where the money should be going?
It should be going to that. The affordable housing is both for home ownership, so first-time home buyer down payment assistance, those types of activities, and then the creation of affordable rental housing. That's where it's supposed to go.
Okay, and here's a snapshot of medium wages for occupations here in Florida that fall below the minimum you need to make to afford a one-bedroom apartment in this state. If you're a security guard, a nursing assistant, a receptionist, you work construction, all kinds of jobs, you don't make enough per hour, Shannon, to afford an apartment. What's the average rent in this area? And, what's the gap between what people are making and what they would need to make to afford an average apartment in Jacksonville?
Sure. According to the report, a two-bedroom apartment on average is $973 a month. If you're making minimum wage, you would have to work two full-time jobs plus have some overtime in order to afford that. You would need to work 88 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom apartment. So if you're a single head of household and you need two bedrooms because you have kids, there's no way you can afford to provide them housing and also have what you need to raise your children.
And so when you said that Ability Housing is trying to address that by putting up some new apartments on the west side, how much will the rent for those be?
Luckily, it will be significantly below the market. We have various rents, and it's different by apartment size. And we're also targeting some of the units for households that have experienced homelessness. So people who are living in motels or doubled up are coming out of facilities, things like that. But unfortunately, it's only 80 units. It's 80 desperately needed units. We're glad we're able to do it. But it's just one piece of the pie. We need to do much more.
Let's go to your calls now as we look at the new Out of Reach report. Is affordable housing a struggle for you? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Andrew is in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Andrew, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking about the topic, and you kind of nailed it with the affordable housing on the west side. I live in Atlantic Beach and am looking to buy a first home. And have been looking outside of the metro areas, and it seems like there's some affordable housing and also land which you could outfit with a relatively inexpensive prefabricated home. And so I think, we kind of got to factor in a little bit of a commute and bite the bullet and move outside of the metro areas. And, it's just part of the growth of the city, and as more people do it, the businesses will follow, and it'll be become more desirable place to live. So, I know it's hard, but you got to sometimes I think look outside of the lines for affordable housing that we're talking about.
Thanks for that call, Andrew. Shannon, do you agree with that?
Well, it is a solution that many households come up with, but in the end, if you layer in the transportation cost, it ends up not being affordable, and it actually becomes a negative economic driver because businesses have trouble having employees who live close by where they work, and the long commutes are disruptive to employment and job stability as well as economic development. So it is something many, many thousands and thousands of households do, but in the end, it's not actually more affordable.
This report makes a full-throated call for increasing the minimum wage, which hasn't gone up in a long time in this country. What do you think about that?
Well, if we want to make housing affordable, we have to address the wage issue. There's so many items in our communities have gone up in price, but wages have, if you, you know, real dollars have remained relatively stagnant for decades. So we have to figure out how we want to make things more affordable. I think one of the things we need to all realize is we all benefit from affordable housing. If our minimum wage is $8.42 or $8.46 here in Florida right now, if you stay in a hotel and the maid is making $8.46 an hour, that makes that room affordable for you. If she had to make what is necessary to afford a place to live, your hotel room is going to be more expensive. So you are benefiting because this individual is being paid less. However, then we need to provide the resources so she and her family can have a quality of life that is acceptable.
And so this is going to become an issue in the next presidential election.
The fight
for 15, the Democratic candidates, some of them, are calling for that. People that are opposed to raising the minimum wage have the same arguments that we've always heard when there's a discussion about whether we need to raise the minimum wage. They say it'll be harder for small businesses to hire people, for one thing. They think that it will be a drag on the economy. What's your response to those arguments?
I am not an economist nor a wage expert, but in my reading of it, the facts that I've read say that that's not how it will happen. There will be adjustments made in the economy, but in the end, if everybody is making what they need to subsist in the community, everybody prospers. Businesses will do better. It'll just have a positive impact across the board. In the end, if we're talking about affordable housing, there are two things to do to make housing affordable: decrease the cost of the housing or increase the income of the household. Those are the two items that can be done. So either create more housing at lower cost or increase the wages. Otherwise, people will not have an affordable place to live.
What about the struggle you face at Ability Housing? People, in theory, agree with the idea that affordable housing should be out there, but they don't want it in their backyard.
Yes, not in my backyard is a very big issue, not just here in Jacksonville. It's unfortunately all over the country. And people just have a misperception. There are bad affordable housing communities out there, Eureka Gardens being Jacksonville's poster child for bad affordable housing. Most affordable housing is high quality. It has the same impacts as any other apartment community does in the neighborhood. There's been multiple studies showing that it will increase property values, decrease crime. It is an asset to the community, and it helps provide the mixed incomes and mixed populations that you want in any healthy community. But there is a stereotype, and people get scared, and there's a lot of education that needs to be done so people can understand. We're talking about housing that is affordable to first responders and teachers and the dry cleaner and the dental hygienist and all of those individuals that we interact with every day and are not scared to have in our lives.
What are some stories you've heard from people that you've provided affordable housing to? What was their situation before they got into an affordable unit through Ability Housing?
That is the most rewarding part of the job, of course, is every time you see a family that's moving into a place they can afford. We have had so many instances where either the reaction is, this is the first time I've lived in a nice place, or this is the first time my mom has ever lived in a new place, or individuals will come in off the streets, and literally I was walking out of the building and they hollered over to me, are you with Ability Housing? And I said, yes. And they go, you saved my life. And then drove off. I don't even know who that was, but it was the most wonderful experience. Literally, we're changing people's lives. We're making it possible for them to not have to work more hours than they need to get the health care they need, to get the jobs that they need. It is the foundation of our life.
Right. Everyone needs a roof over their head.
It's Maslow's hierarchy.
If you're just tuning in, as we speak with Shannon Nasworth, CEO of Ability Housing, we'll go to some more of your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Is affordable housing out of reach for you? Let us know your situation. And that goes for homeowners, too. Let's talk about that for a minute. This report, Out of Reach, looks at rental housing.
Correct.
But millions of Americans, especially younger Americans, look at homeownership as something that is not in the cards for them. They just don't think they'll ever be able to save enough money to afford a house.
And that is true. And it's part of the reason we have a rental market problem. If people can't get out of rental housing into homeownership, then there's more demand on the rental market. So it is having an impact on rental. But we just don't create housing that is affordable for first-time homebuyers. Part of it is zoning choices that we make. We insist that lots be bigger, setbacks be more, et cetera, which makes housing more expensive. Land is more expensive. We've had multiple hurricanes, so labor and materials, tariffs, everything is causing things to be more expensive. And builders have the right to make a profit. That's what everybody else goes to work to make money, and they have the right to do the same. So they can make more money building larger homes.
It's a real change from our parents' and grandparents' eras.
It is.
Where getting into a starter home, as they used to be called, mm-hmm. it wasn't easy, but it was attainable.
It was obtainable, and now it's just literally out of reach for too many families.
And how does that translate to the larger economy, Shannon? If a growing number of Americans can't get into a home or can't even rent a decent apartment, there's a ripple effect.
Oh, there's absolutely a ripple effect. If people have to commute long distances or have to jump around from apartment to apartment because they can't afford, the impact on their employer is very demonstrable. There is a loss in production, there's a loss in productivity, and there's also a lower job stability. If people just flip from jobs to jobs, and we know that's expensive to employers to have new employees. It is an economic development issue, and it's something that the Chamber of Commerce across the state is beginning to realize. The lack of an affordable place to live is making it harder to bring new companies to their area because those companies want to know their employees can live near where they want them to work.
Now, a minute ago, you mentioned the lofts at La Villa in downtown Jacksonville. A big company, Vestcor, is putting those up. What's the rent on those?
I'm not sure. I do know it's well below market, but I honestly...
And market is $900 a month.
For a two-bedroom, yes, roughly.
So if you're renting a one-bedroom in an affordable housing complex downtown, one of the new ones, you're paying maybe what, between $500 and $600 a month?
I would assume it's in the 600s. I don't know exactly, to be mm-hmm. honest, but I would assume it's somewhere in that range, yes.
Okay. Here's an email from Aaron. Why are we okay with management making six-figure salaries and yet workers make less in percentages to inflation? The rich are getting richer off the backs of the workers. The top 1% continue to keep wages low so they can keep the money within their budget. What about that? That's from a listener.
Well, I think that's a comment that many people are making. There's a lot of discontent with the system that we have created for ourselves. And I think that's the thing we need to realize. We have the system that we have created. If we want it differently, then we have to make it change.
And as you said, either housing costs have to go down or wages have to go up.
That's the only way you're going to have affordable housing.
And how does ability housing work on policy issues like that, besides putting roofs over people's heads?
Yes, obviously the most direct thing is putting roofs over people's heads. We also help people with rental assistance so that they can access market housing. But we're very involved, especially at the state level, but more increasingly at the federal level, trying to advocate with legislators to appropriate more money to affordable housing, trying to help them understand how important it is that these resources be used for their intended purpose.
Shannon Nesworth, she's the CEO of Ability Housing. The new report is called Out of Reach. Shannon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And much more still ahead. Up next, it's been called the state's biggest new cash crop. But can Florida's hemp industry get off the ground? That's in a moment. You're listening to First Coast Connect, and we'll be right back.
Life can be messy, but when the bomb's ticking down, the dam's breaking, or Jimmy's in the well, you don't have time to do things the right way. Now, on the Next Snap Judgment, you need a quick fix.
Quick fix.
Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit WJCT.org/events to explore what's coming your way.
The
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's being called Florida's hottest new cash crop. But can the state's hemp industry get off the ground? Here's the problem. Governor DeSantis may not sign a bill into law that sets up some regulation for the production of hemp in Florida. So what's going on here? We decided to find out as we welcome Sally Kent Peebles. She's a partner at Vicente Cederberg, and she serves on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Hey, Sally.
Good morning.
Also with us, Shelton Hull. He writes a weekly cannabis column for Folio Weekly. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And to our callers, what are your questions about the state's hemp industry and medical marijuana in Florida? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. All right, Sally Kent Peebles, let's begin with you. What is the Florida Hemp Bill?
So as a little bit of an overview, back in December, the federal government passed the 2018 Farm Bill, and that legalized hemp. It took it removed hemp from the definition of marijuana, which removed it as a controlled substance. So at the federal level, hemp became legal. What it also did is task the states to develop their own program. So everyone that we were, you know, for a while there, we were kind of saying, what is Florida going to do? Well, the legislator was great enough to pass the hemp farming bill about a month ago. It has yet to be signed by the governor. We do expect the governor to sign, hopefully this week or next. And what that does is it created a hemp program to license the cultivation of hemp. It also provided a pathway for the sale and distribution of hemp extract, as long as it's tested, packaged, and labeled accurately. And it carved out hemp and industrial hemp from the definition of cannabis in the Florida Criminal Code, which is really critical because now if you're caught with, say, you know, a bushel of hemp, it's not considered a bushel of marijuana.
Not the same thing. Okay. Shelton Hull, the state's agriculture commissioner, Nikki Freed, said she wants to see a hemp revolution in Florida. What does she mean by that?
I don't know. At first, I thought it was a ban, but apparently it's a policy proposal that she's going for. Now, with the hemp bill, one thing to note is a lot of CBD is extracted from hemp, so that's going to increase the market for that. And, of course, here in Florida, we all know about the clothing market and paper, things like that. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader up in D.C., he's from Kentucky, which has traditionally, historically been one of the top hemp-producing states in the country. Mm-hmm. And so his support for that, you know, it's been a very bipartisan thing all along. And what Nikki Freed is doing with this, with her so-called hemp revolution is, you know, for lack of a better word, kind of revolutionary. The governor's kind of stood back and given her free rein to work through this as she sees fit. And she recognizes that we've already turned this in the medical marijuana business just in general into a multi-million dollar market. And now by opening things up to more hemp production and then hopefully potentially legal use down the road, we are looking at, you know, maybe a $1 billion industry as we get down in the next like 5-10 years.
So many agricultural products are made from hemp, Sally, but isn't it already legal under the federal government? Why do we need this law in Florida?
So industrial hemp is, after the Farm Bill was passed, industrial hemp is fully legal. It did also provide for interstate commerce of it. But really what's critical here, especially in Florida, is while the Farm Bill legalized industrial hemp, it carved out the regulation of CBD and all the other cannabinoids within the hemp plant to the FDA. So the FDA has the regulatory authority over all consumable products. And what they're saying right now is that it is not, you know, it's not lawful to put a CBD into a consumable product. So that's confusing to a lot of people because in Florida, you see these CBD products everywhere. So part of the Florida Hemp Bill, they do provide a pathway for the sale and distribution of these CBD products. But the key is here that is still subject to the FDA. But it will help some of these retailers breathe a little easier when they're selling products. So now it's legal at the state level and the federal level, except for this little weird FDA rule.
Hemp-derived CBD. It's legal to buy. It doesn't get you high. It can relieve your pain and anxiety. It's also unregulated in Florida. So what are your questions about new hemp regulations for the Sunshine State? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937 as we talk hemp. Okay, who's opposed to this hemp bill? Sally?
I actually haven't received any sort of pushback. There's always rumblings that maybe the regulated market for, people who otherwise sell CBD, and when I say that, I'm referring to medical marijuana or adult use suppliers, could be potentially pushed back. But what we're actually seeing is that a lot of these MMTCs, the medical marijuana treatment centers, are actually selling CBD in their waiting rooms. So I don't really feel like they're missing out on the revenue there. I think that could be a bit of a conspiracy theory. And, I think it's pretty well received by most parties.
Okay. Speaking of dispensaries, Shelton Hull, you write a column looking at the growth of the medical marijuana industry in Florida. New dispensaries are opening up around town all the time.
Absolutely. And we're talking about the hemp bill and legal use and things like that. These companies are moving ahead quickly, regardless of how the law is going. And so if you look at where the money is flowing right now, everyone seems to think that we're going to move full speed ahead along the road with all this. We just had a place partnering with AltMed Florida. They opened up in San Marco, right across the bridge here on Hendricks Avenue, last week. And Sally was telling me that they have come out of nowhere. Really, they started up here probably a year or two after most of the other MMTCs began, but they've already taken up a massive amount of market share. They have, I believe, this was the eighth location in Florida that they opened last week, and they have another 12 planned between now and, I believe, the end of the year. And there's a MedMen, which is a great name for that.
MedMen?
MedMen.
Okay.
They're opening up in Five Points in the old Fans and Stoves building. That will be the largest MMTC place in Northeast Florida once it's open. And there's another one coming to Mandarin.
Wow. So it's everywhere. Sally Kent Peebles, the medical marijuana dispensary market is going straight up. If this hemp bill gets signed into law, that is on a rocket ship into space, too. Billions of dollars in revenue for the state of Florida. And this is a product that can be used in a lot of interesting ways. It can replace styrofoam. It can reduce landfill waste. Can you tell us a little bit more about how hemp is used in those areas?
Yeah, so industrial hemp is an incredible product. One of my favorite uses is to make hempcrete. It's an alternative to concrete. Hemp grows very quickly and without pesticides. So you can, it's sustainable and it's, I believe it is helpful when you build a home, and it insulates it very well. Also, you have hemp actually, when you grow it, can take the toxins out of the soil itself. So where we've seen any sort of chemical damage to soil, you can throw hemp into the ground, and it's helpful in that way. And of course, textiles. And of course, that's what we're talking about, CBD uses as well.
Okay, lots of calls as we talk about the growth of the hemp industry in Florida. It's being called the hemp revolution, particularly if new regulations around the growth of hemp get signed into law. Governor DeSantis will likely sign this by the end of the month. What are your thoughts? What are your questions? It's 549-2937. Let's go to Patricia in Mandarin. Hey, Patricia, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. What are your questions about hemp?
My question is regarding the location of where to actually plant the hemp, because I keep hearing the term backyard gardening, and my backyard is quite shady. So I'm considering planting some hemp, but it would have to be on the side of my property, and I don't want that accessible to just any neighbor that wants to get high. I don't want my neighbors coming over and thinking I'm a pothead. I don't want any of the, I don't want any of the drama. I just want to make a little cash, okay?
I hear you. Okay.
Where do I proceed if I'm interested in doing this? How do I proceed cautiously? I don't want any pushback from anybody.
I understand. That's Patricia in Mandarin. What should Patricia do, Sally?
So the state released some proposed rules to implement Senate Bill 1020 just last night, and they clarified where hemp will be grown. It has to be on lands that are used primarily for bona fide agricultural purposes. So unless your backyard falls under that category, we probably won't be seeing home grows of hemp anytime soon. However, they did include a provision in there that they would revisit where hemp can be grown after 2 years. The concern there is that they believe hemp could be an invasive species, so they're trying to make sure that they control where the hemp is being grown.
All right, let's go to Paul in downtown Jacksonville. Hey, Paul, thanks for your call.
Good morning. How are you, Melissa?
Good, thanks.
Good. Bee Friends Farms are going to be infusing the CBD isolate into our honey in August. And I've been using CBD oil from a Bliss out in Bend, Oregon for about 4 to 5 months. And I've noticed a beneficial results in my arthritis and aches and pains and so on. And it's important that people understand that the hemp that most of the CBD is coming from is less than 1% of THC, which is what gets you high. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's important is that your product have isolate in it and not a compounded hemp. So we're looking forward to it. We're going to introduce it at the Honey Festival August 17th. And, we believe that it's a great product and people should be taking it.
Thanks, Paul. And let me just say the honey from Bee Friends Farm, which is made locally, is delicious. Yes. Everybody go pick some up.
Thank you.
And come on out to the Honey Bee Festival in August at the fairgrounds. And he makes an important point, Shelton. You know, so many products now have CBD in them, and it's important for people that are using the product in their manufacturing and for the consumer to use a high-quality product. How can people know if the CBD oil that they're getting, as he pointed out, has isolates, is high quality?
Well, one cool thing about the slow pace of implementing all these laws is that the companies involved have been very diligent about information, letting people know. When the medical marijuana bill first went to the ballot in 2014, it failed at the last moment, largely because of a wave of disinformation that played on the ignorance of voters about difference between hemp and marijuana, THC levels, all the old stereotypes about it'll make you listen to jazz and go crazy in the streets.
God forbid.
Yeah, we always remember Reefer Madness was intended as like almost a documentary, one of those scared straight type stories. And so between 2014 and 2016, the companies involved in this market have done a really good job of educating the public. So when it comes to, from the consumer standpoint, when you go to any dispensary or any MMTC or places like the Bee Farms Honey, as you just saw, they know their subject, they know their product very well, and they will tell you about it. It's almost like craft brewing. You go to get a craft beer, they'll tell you about all the hops and all the this and that that's put in it. So the consumer doesn't have to worry. It's actually, CBD is really one of the more clearly defined consumer products out there now.
549-2937. Lots of calls about the state's new hemp industry. Brandon is on the west side. Hi, Brandon. What are your thoughts?
Hi, good morning. What I'm really excited about is the craft hemp trend. And of course, hemp is just another form of cannabis that has less than 0.3% THC. But what I really think is important for consumers to know, and by the way, I'm a part of the Sativa Science Club based out of Portland, Oregon.
Oh, okay.
I live here in Jacksonville.
What's really the Sativa Science Club?
The Sativa Science Club is one of the first nationally recognized attempts. It was recognized by Forbes for having acquired Dr. Mike McCormick from MIT, a biochemist professor. And it's one of the first attempts to really standardize the level of education in the cannabis space, but also so that bud tenders are more educated so that they can inform patients about the real actual medicinal benefits. For example, isolate CBD is not as effective unless it's combined with THC and interacts with the other minor cannabinoids and terpenes in the plant, which really gives it that entourage effect. And the medicinal benefit of hemp is only going to be as good as the flower is. Some flower is just better at producing hemp than these minor cannabinoids and terpenes that work together. So I'm wondering if the regulations going into place will require testing for some of these minor cannabinoids, terpenes, toxic metals, mold, etc. That way we have the best quality plant for the patient.
Sure. Thanks for that. This is Brandon on the West Side. Sally, how will the regulations ensure quality?
So in the rules that I mentioned a moment ago that have been released last night, the proposed version of the rules do have strict testing requirements that include pesticide testing, potency testing, metals. And so all of your concerns will be addressed. The reason for these rules and the reason that these laws are coming out is because there is so much CBD on the market right now, and it is unregulated. And that is concerning. I'm a huge marijuana supporter, but it is concerning that anyone can make a CBD product, put it on a shelf, and just label it with whatever they want. It could have THC in it, higher levels of THC, and affect someone negatively. It could have, like you said, heavy metals or pesticides attached. So what these rules and what Florida is doing right now is trying to regulate it and make sure these products are done so in compliance with the law for public safety.
And let me ask you this, Shelton. The agriculture industry has really been struggling in Florida in recent years. If hemp is regulated properly and given the right kind of environment to grow, literally grow from a business sense, this is really, the revenue potential is extraordinary. Have you heard from people who've thought about farming hemp? They've thought, oh, I see the potential in this.
I hear people talking about it all the time, usually late at night at the bar. But absolutely, a lot of industry professionals are already looking forward to getting involved in this. Thankfully, we have people like Sally on the new marijuana advisory board that the state has set up, which is a really nice thing. They're being very careful about defining the law for all these products as specifically as possible. And with the market as saturated as it is right now for CBD, all the incentive is on the retailer to be clear about their definitions and clear about what it does and what's in it in order to compete in the marketplace. I think, I don't know, you know, as the lady was saying earlier about wanting to grow it in her yard, you can't grow the hemp in your yard now, but I think with this rise in community farms and things like that all over, especially here in Northeast Florida, as you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of room for that and room to grow, as they say. Mm-hmm. And let me also say that Sativa Science Club guy, please contact me. I'd like to know more about that, and I really want a T-shirt.
Right. Email Shelton at Folio Weekly. Can you throw us your email address real quick?
SheltonHall@gmail.com.
Okay. And Sally, as he mentioned, you are part of the state's new Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. What's the purpose of this committee?
So we are a group of industry experts everywhere from, you know, legal expert like I am. We have patients and activists and stakeholders, people who are in the industry. And we are going to attend hearings around the state. There's actually one this Thursday in Fort Lauderdale, one in Tampa on Friday, and then one in Tallahassee on Monday. If you go to the DOA's website, you could see, you know, how to participate in that. But we are going to be creating a pathway for concerned citizens or those interested in the industry can provide input on these rules that were released last night. And also moving forward, not just on the hemp industry, but in the medical marijuana field. There's a lot of grumblings out there, and we want to make sure that those are being addressed. And then we're going to get together as a board and discuss how to solve those things and then work directly with the Department of Agriculture to address those issues.
Now, what happens if Governor DeSantis decides to veto this bill? What happens to the industry then?
Well, technically, if he does that, it would not be able to be addressed again until the next year's spring legislative session, unfortunately. I believe that's how the system would work. If he does veto it, the system would move forward as it is right now. I mean, I think it would be unfortunate because their local and federal enforcement agencies do not have the funds to go out and oversee all of this unregulated product. So unfortunately, it would probably go on and being sold, which could be a public health risk.
Yeah, I would say it's probably really unlikely that DeSantis would veto the bill because so much of the activity with this industry so far this year has been largely driven from the governor's office. As you know, Rick Scott, his predecessor, was adamant about blocking implementation of Amendment 2 at every step of the way. And since DeSantis came in, one of the first things he did was push through that bill for the smokable product. And he, like I said before, he's really empowered Nikki Free to kind of, you know, go her own way, as Fleetwood Mac would say, on this subject. And so one would assume that for the bill
She got elected on this issue.
Absolutely.
As agriculture commissioner, she campaigned on the opening up of medical marijuana in the state.
Absolutely. And as you know, with the Israel trip a couple of weeks ago, she was part of that. She left for Israel before the rest of the delegation went and was kind of taking her own separate agenda, dealing with Israeli companies related to it. So one would assume for the bill to have gotten as far as it is, as it's gotten so far in a Republican-dominated legislature, one would assume that that is happening at the behest of the governor himself.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Don't forget the nutritional benefits of hemp seed consumption.
Yes.
Hemp is used in thousands of ways, as we're talking about right now with Sally Kent Peebles, attorney. She serves on the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee, and Shelton Hall, who writes a weekly cannabis column for Folio. And let me ask you both as a follow-up. Medical marijuana now legal in the state. Hemp production almost certainly going straight up in the state of Florida. The next frontier is, of course, somewhat more controversial, full recreational legalization of marijuana in the state of Florida. Activists are mobilizing to try to make that happen. What are the prospects for them to be successful?
Well, they're mobilizing, but they're not that mobile. They need to really step it up. The goal is to get it on the ballot for November 2020. I wrote about this a few weeks ago. They're well behind on their numbers as far as getting signatures through. And a recent bill that went through dealing with the petition process could potentially complicate their ability to get enough signatures to get it done. One would hope that the dispensaries and all these companies that have invested millions and millions of dollars, you know, on the front end in expectation that this is going to happen soon, would start putting in their resources in order to make it happen. Because I would say, as Sally was telling me earlier, really the next 2 to 3 months this summer is the crucial time. If they don't really accelerate their signature gathering between now and, say, Labor Day.
They won't get it on the ballot next year.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, keep your eye on the governor's ballpoint pen or fountain pen. If he signs this bill into law, we will see a new regulation around hemp and CBD in the state of Florida. Thanks to our experts, Sally Peebles, attorney at Vincente Cederberg, and Shelton Hull. Always good to have your cannabis insights on the program. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in a moment, the cast of the Broadway hit Chicago and all that jazz on a local stage this weekend. We'll be right back.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. 1 in 5 high school students in America now uses e-cigarettes. Many of them are disciplined because the use of products like Juul are against school rules. But one high school principal in Connecticut wants to treat vaping as an addiction and offer kids education rather than just punishment. We'll talk with him next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
In New York, tenant advocates are celebrating a sweeping new law designed to protect renters across the state.
There's the right to make sure repairs are done, or at least being able to have some comfort in making a complaint to, like, buildings and codes and not feeling like you're about to be retaliated against.
Landlords say the law will reduce the supply of affordable housing. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Some records are getting smashed on the soccer pitch.
You don't see 13-0 results at a World Cup, but you saw it tonight.
And other records are getting smashed off the field. Across the world, more people are watching the Women's World Cup than ever before. But the battle for America's women is still to come. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Have you checked out WJCT's storytelling podcast, What It's Like?
We sing praises to the Khmer Rouge leader. They were always enforcing rules.
Some people are still figuring things out.
When you have PTSD, I don't know why certain battles come up and certain battles don't. Mm-hmm. I guess it's maybe the battles that really impacted you.
Others have come out on the other side.
When he started saying he was loving me more, I couldn't believe it.
Subscribe to What It's Like wherever you get your podcasts.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, Roxy and Velma take center stage this weekend at the Pontevedra Concert Hall. They're the delightfully murderous duo from the hit Broadway show Chicago. This is a production of Apex Theater Studio. Here with more, show director A.J. Allegra, star Gina Haylock, who plays Roxy, and Ian Mayers, who runs Apex Theater. Guys, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. This is such a great show. Everyone's so excited about it. First, though, Ian Mayers, you had a little trouble getting the costumes together for Chicago.
Yeah,
What's going on?
We've got like 100 showgirl costumes we're trying to move, and it's raining like every half an hour right now, and I don't want any wet feathers. We got a lot of feathers, a lot of sequins.
So you had some issues getting everything transported.
We've been trying for the past 2 days to move them from our rehearsal facility on Palm Valley Road to the Pontevedra Concert Hall, and it's been tough. We load up the truck, it starts to rain, we roll them back in.
Oh, man.
Because I don't want soggy showgirls.
The things you do for theater, right?
Amen, sister. You got to do it.
Okay, now this show, anyone who's ever seen Chicago, either on stage or on the big screen in the movie version, knows how great it is. Let's start with you, AJ. You're the director. And anyone who watched the recent FX series Fosse Verdon knows about Bob Fosse and his ex-wife Gwen Verdon and how they together brought Chicago to the stage.
Yeah.
It's a great production. How exciting is it to direct this?
It's a great opportunity to direct it. It's my second time directing Chicago, and what I love about it is that it feels so American because it's about, you know, sensationalism in the news and how people are, you know, going after fame and fortune through illicit means. And it's, you know, any Bob Fosse show has such a classic stamp on it, and it has that kind of seductive movement that is, you know, present throughout the show that is just so much fun to be able to see the performers at Apex, you know, master, and they've done it in such a short amount of time. It's incredible.
Excellent. Now, Gina, you play Roxy Hart. You are a rising junior at FSU. What's
yes.
it like to play Roxy?
Oh, it's so much fun. I love being able to play kind of the villain in a sense, but a villain that everyone loves. She's terrible in the best way possible, and it's so much fun. And the whole cast is a joy to work with.
It's a fun show, and the dancing and the musical numbers are just mind-blowing. Anyone who's seen it on stage knows what I'm talking about. I really encourage everyone to go see it. How did you end up choosing this for your summer season?
Well, we usually, every year, we just start in our musical theater dance styles workshop working on things. Last year was a chorus line, which was a huge hit. And we started, and the kids started saying, I want some Fosse. bring me the Fosse. So we just started working Cell Block Tango, probably one of the most iconic numbers from the show, last fall. And then just started gaining momentum. And I had met AJ and knew he'd just done a really successful production in New Orleans, where he's based out of. And so it was kismet. And we're so excited to really do the Northeast Florida premiere of this version.
Why do you do live theater? What drives you to do live theater?
Well, there's nothing like it. You know, people say like, oh, we're competing with cell phones and mobile devices, but nothing compares to Gina makes a sound 10 feet away from you and you hear it. And she makes a move and she gives off a kind of energy as a performer. And, you know, you can't find that on a telephone. So it's really exciting and people want to gather and connect. And that's what we do at Apex.
And this is, by the way, just one of the shows you're doing this summer.
Yes, we're touring with our second annual Shakespeare, which Gina's also featured in, A Midsummer Night's Dream, which will be at 7 locations in 10 days all over Northeast Florida and South Georgia. And also for the younger members of the family, we have Pinkalicious, the musical, about a little girl who eats too much cupcakes and turns pink.
Something for everybody. But Gina, you've been wearing those dancing shoes for months now, rehearsing for this. So nervous at all about opening night?
Not so much nervous as just excited to be able to share this with the community. I think that it's awesome that Ponte Vedra Concert Hall is going to be able to put this up and, share this with the Ponte Vedra neighborhood.
And AJ, as Ian pointed out, you are here from New Orleans. So are you enjoying your time here? I am.
I run a theater in New Orleans. And, you know, Ian and I met at a grad school program. And this is my first time in Jacksonville. And I've loved it. I've loved exploring the different areas of town and the area by the beach. And it's been a great opportunity because the weather here is very similar to New Orleans, you know. When I arrived, it was raining and then it was not, and then the steam was rising up and I felt like I was home again.
You felt right at home. That's right. Well, if you love Bob Fosse and you love musicals, don't miss Chicago. It's this Friday at Apex Theater Studio at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Tickets at apextheaterjax.com. Ian Mayers, thanks for being here, along with your star, Gina Haylock, and your director, AJ Allegra.
It's our pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Jazz hands.
Jazz hands. pvconcerthall.com.
That's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director, and we always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, we speak with Duval County School Superintendent Dr. Diana Green. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. Enjoy the music. Have a great day. And all that jet. Hold on, hon. We're gonna bunny hug. I bought some aspirin down at United Drug. In case you shake up hard, I want a brand new start to do that. Jazz. Let's go, babe. But I didn't even meet your friend. That manager guy. Don't worry, Roxy. It's all taken care of. Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.